Catherine to find not only that her new boss, Dorothy Vaughn, was a fellow West Virginian, but that their families had once been neighbors. It didn't take long for Catherine to appreciate that Dorothy wasn't just a talented mathematician. She was also a great supervisor. For 2 weeks, Catherine worked at her new desk in West Computing, hitting the ground running. Then one morning, an engineer came into the office and quietly conferred with Dorothy. "The Flight Research Division needs 2 new computers," Dorothy Vaughn announced. The Flight Research Division was a group that specialized in testing real planes rather than wind tunnels. "Catherine and Irma, I'm sending the two of you," assigning Catherine and another West computer to the job. Confusing signals. For Catherine, being given an assignment in the Flight Research Division, whose office was on the top floor of Langley's gigantic hangar, felt like good fortune. She had been elated to work in the pool and calculate her way through the data sheets, but being sent to work closely with the engineers was even more exciting. With just her lunch bag and purse to carry, Catherine went over to the hangar, which was a short walk from the West Computing office. She slipped in the side door, climbed the stairs, and walked down a dim cinder block hallway to the Flight Research Laboratory. Inside, the room smelled like coffee and cigarettes. The engineers smoked and drank coffee all day while they were working. Like West Computing, the office was set up in classroom style with about 20 desks. Most of the people on the team were men, but there were a few other women in the group working as computers. Catherine looked for a place to wait for her new bosses. She went to an empty cube and sat down next to a white engineer. Before she had a chance to say hello, the man gave her a sideways glance, then got up and walked away. Had she done something wrong? No one else noticed what happened, but Catherine didn't know whether his action was meant to be insulting. It could have been because she was black and he was white. It could have been because she was a woman and he was a man. It could have been because he was a professional and she was a sub-professional. Or it could have meant nothing at all. Outside the Langley campus, the rules were clear. Blacks and whites lived separately, ate separately, studied separately, socialized separately, worshipped separately, and for the most part, worked separately. At Langley, the boundaries were fuzzy. Some of her colleagues were northerners or foreigners who'd never so much as met a black person before arriving at Langley. Others were from the Deep South, with strong attitudes about racial mixing. It was all a part of the racial relations laboratory at Langley. Blacks and whites were exploring new ground together. Catherine and the other black mathematicians mounted a charm offensive. They made a special effort to always be well-dressed, well-spoken, patriotic, and upright. They were keenly aware that the interactions that individual blacks had with whites could have implications for the entire black community. Within 2 weeks, whatever had caused the engineer to move away from Catherine's desk had faded from his mind as the two got to know one another. The man was more than pleased when he discovered that his new office mate was a fellow transplant from West Virginia, and they became fast friends. West Virginia never left Catherine's heart, but Virginia, it would soon be clear, was her destiny. Chapter 13. Turbulence. After 6 months, Catherine Goebel's temporary assignment to the Flight Research Division was starting to look permanent. At the beginning of 1954, Dorothy Vaughn sat down with Catherine's boss in the division. "Either give her a raise or send her back to me," Dorothy said. Although Catherine had spent only 2 weeks in the West Area Computing Office when she first arrived at Langley, she was still Dorothy's responsibility. The way Dorothy saw the matter, Catherine should either be classified as a permanent member of West Computing and continue to rotate through other temporary assignments, or she should become an official member of the flight research division. Even though the manager Catherine reported to was not an advocate of women in the workforce, the meeting ended as both the manager and Dorothy Vaughn knew it would. Catherine received an offer to join the division full-time with an increase in salary. The engineers who worked with Catherine realized that she was a keeper soon after she showed them her mathematical skills. Her familiarity with higher-level math made her a versatile addition to the branch. The Flight Research Division was a collection of high-energy, free-thinking, aggressive, and very smart engineers. They spent their time not in the wind tunnels, but with live aircraft. They were serious about their work. The head of the Flight Research Division had actually trained as a test pilot in order to improve the quality of his research reports. The division was the kind of place that would not show patience to anyone, male or female, who took too long to figure out how things were supposed to be done. Fortunately, Catherine Goebel's natural curiosity and her confidence in her own mathematical ability gave her the courage to ask the engineers a lot of questions. They didn't hesitate to explain what they knew. They spent a good part of their lives thinking about flight, and they could talk about it endlessly. Branches within the Flight Research Division investigated different topics, such as planes that could travel faster than the speed of sound, and even ones that might be capable of flying into outer space. One of the tasks of the Maneuver Loads branch, where Catherine worked, was to examine safety concerns and investigate plane crashes. A bumpy ride. Catherine's first assignment in the group was to help figure out what went wrong in an accident involving a small Piper propeller plane. The plane, which was flying along in an unremarkable fashion, literally fell out of the clear blue sky and crashed without apparent cause. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics received the plane's flight recorder, a device that tracks an aircraft's speed, acceleration, altitude, and other measures of flight. The information was essential to figuring out what had happened. It was Catherine's job to analyze the photographic images of the plane's instruments, recorded in very small increments of time. Hour after hour, day after day, she looked through a film reader, studying what was happening to the plane before the crash. She learned that the propeller plane flew in a path perpendicular to that of a larger jet plane that had passed through the area a few minutes before. The engineers set up an experiment, recreating the circumstances of the accident, flying a test plane into the trailing wake of a larger plane. The data from that experiment also arrived on Catherine's desk. It was eye-straining, monotonous computer work, but Catherine loved it. When the engineers analyzed Catherine's work, they were fascinated to recognize something they hadn't realized before. The data showed that the air disturbance caused by a jet that flew past could trouble the air for as long as a half hour after it had passed through. This wave of air had tripped up the smaller propeller plane as it flew through it, causing it to stumble and crash. This was a revelation, and Catherine was thrilled to be a part of the team that uncovered it. The research done by Catherine and the engineers on the team led to changes in air traffic regulations, requiring minimum distances between flight paths to prevent similar accidents. Catherine thought that report was one of the most interesting things she had ever read. She also felt satisfied to have helped with such an important project. From the beginning, Catherine felt at home at Langley. She took a genuine liking to her new colleagues, who were opinionated, high energy, and interesting. Best of all, as far as Catherine was concerned, they were smart as whips. Like other black people, Catherine was aware that discrimination existed at Langley, just as it existed in other areas of life. But she made the decision to block it out of her daily routine. She refused to allow herself to worry about it too much. When she first took the job, she didn't realize the bathrooms were segregated. Not every building had a colored bathroom, and the ones for the white women were unmarked. As far as Catherine was concerned, there was no reason why she shouldn't use the unmarked bathrooms as well. The next challenge. After they'd been living in Newsome Park for 2 years, Catherine's husband said, "I want to move our girls out of the projects." Living in the subdivision when they first arrived in town had made it possible for the family to become a part of the Black community in the area very quickly. But they decided to move to Mimosa Crescent, a World War II-era neighborhood in Hampton that had been built for middle-class Black families. In 1946, Mimosa Crescent had more than doubled in size, growing from its original 22 houses to 51. The area attracted more prosperous families who were able to afford the 3- and 4-bedroom brick houses. With a lovely new home, a job she loved, and her 3 daughters all doing well in school, Catherine felt she was living the American dream, at least for a while. Then, over the course of 1955, her husband began to feel sick, first with headaches, then with unexplained weakness. Ultimately, his doctors discovered a tumor at the base of his skull, where it could not be treated. His health declined over more than a year, and much of that time he was in the hospital. Catherine's husband, James Francis Goebel, died 5 days before Christmas in 1956. Catherine was devastated, of course, but she refused to give in to her grief. She had made a promise to her husband that she would do everything in her power to keep their bright, lively daughters on the path that they had paved for them. Catherine allowed herself and the girls until the end of the year to mourn, and then she expected them all to get back to work. On the first day of school in January 1957, Catherine met with the school principal. "It is very important that you don't show the girls any special treatment or let up on them in any way," she said. "They are going to college, and they need to be prepared." Now that she was a single mother, Catherine established the new household rules. "You will have my clothes ironed and ready in the morning, and dinner ready when I come home," she told her daughters. Catherine was now both mother and father, the one who offered love and discipline, the sole breadwinner. Each of them would have to work hard to pull the family through the difficult time. The Goebel children excelled in school. They took piano and violin lessons and practiced diligently. They were good-natured, outgoing, and respectful. With her steady gaze on the future, Catherine led her daughters toward the long-promised blessings of democracy. She wasn't leading the life she had expected, but she accepted the new challenges with dignity. Catherine's husband's death divided her life in two. As a couple, they had walked side by side through graduate school and marriage, the birth of their children and their move to Newport News. Now, at just 38 years old, she was a widow and a single mother, as well as a professional woman realizing her intellectual dream. Her husband wouldn't be there to see those dreams come to fruition, but he had helped get her career launched. All that had come before would connect to all that was to come. In January 1957, Catherine's daughters went back to school, and she went back to work. The second act of her life was about to begin. Chapter 14. Progress. The years after World War II were an age of technological progress. Jet engines replaced propellers. Reaching Mach 1 left engineers hungry to conquer Mach 2. Supersonic flight led to still faster hypersonic flight. Each breakthrough pushed the imaginations of inventors and engineers a little bit further, tempting the workers at the Langley Memorial Aeronautics Laboratory to envision a time when they eventually would create an aircraft capable of breaking free of Earth's gravity and reaching outer space. One step in this march of progress had occurred in 1947, when Langley bought its first electronic calculator from Bell Telephone Laboratories. No one confused the female calculators with the room-sized calculating machines that performed the same function. As the years passed and the electronic computers became more important to the work done at Langley, Dorothy Vaughan could envision a time when her team of human computers would be replaced by the inanimate calculating machines. The future was coming. Dorothy didn't know exactly what the new computers would look like, but she knew that technology was going to change the way things were done at the laboratory. The new machines. The electronic calculators were needed for the more elaborate research being carried out by the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. As planes flew faster than the speed of sound, the math required to study those supersonic flights had become increasingly complicated. Some of the algebraic equations the mathematicians were asked to perform had as many as 35 variables and might take as long as a month to solve. The new electronic calculator could complete the same problem in just a few hours. These computers were fast, but they weren't easy to use. The machines used paper punch tapes, long strips of paper with holes punched out to store data as input, and chugged along at 2 seconds per math operation, like addition or subtraction. The whole building shook when the machine was in use, but it offered the distinct advantage that it could operate all night long. The female computers needed to go home to rest. A new era. In the mid-1950s, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics bought its first computers from IBM, an IBM 604 electronic calculating punch and an IBM 650. The engineers needed them to calculate the flight path for a hypersonic, above Mach 5, rocket plane, an experimental aircraft that would fly high enough and fast enough to leave Earth's atmosphere and break the pull of Earth's gravity in order to reach space. At first, these data processing machines weren't very reliable. They made mistakes, and engineers, or the human computers who worked for the engineers, had to keep an eye on the output. In the 1950s, the electronic computers with their million-dollar-plus price tags were only used by large research facilities. They were fast, but they could still process just one job at a time. They chugged out answers around the clock, but competition for computing time remained fierce. Every engineer wanted time on the machines. Only the most short-sighted of the human computers failed to see that the electronic computers were going to dominate the future. The machines brought vast amounts of computing power and efficiency to the research process. Evolution occurred in scientific progress, just as it does in nature. Positive traits continued and obsolete ones died off. For example, propeller research had been one of Langley's most important areas of investigation at one time, but the propeller planes were replaced by faster jet engines. By 1951, the propeller tunnel was declared obsolete and demolished. Engineers who had staffed it were left to find a new specialty or retire. The same thing was going to be true of the human computers. They would have to evolve or they would become obsolete. The machines didn't immediately threaten the mathematicians' jobs, but Dorothy Vaughan realized that mastering the electronic calculators would be the key to job security. When Langley started giving classes in computer programming after work and on weekends, she signed up, and she encouraged the women in her group to do the same. Dorothy knew there would be more direct and open competition with the white computers, and African-American women had to meet or exceed the standards. But she expected that those new jobs would be open to her and the other computers if they were ready. "Integration is going to come," she said. She recognized that the blurring of the color lines could put her and her team in a position to qualify for the desirable jobs that were going to open up for people who were experts in managing the electronic computers. To keep moving forward, African American women needed to take advantage of every opportunity for additional training. Dorothy attended all the classes on computer programming that she could find. Langley offered a series of after-work lectures on aerodynamics there at the laboratory. Other classes were offered at Hampton Institute, the Langley Air Force Base, the College of William and Mary, and Newport News High School. Hampton High School was the seat of the University of Virginia's Extension School, one of Langley's campuses. In the evenings, Langley's top researchers taught classes to laboratory employees at the city's only public high school, but the high school was off limits to the city's African American children, who were sent to Phoenix High School on the campus of Hampton Institute. School segregation had become a red-hot topic across the country. Politicians and ordinary citizens debated the quality of its schools, especially how American students compared to Soviet students in math and science. The goal of raising the general level of technical proficiency had only grown stronger as the rift between the United States and the Soviet Union intensified. The fear of communism and spies had exploded during the period that became known as the Cold War. In the United States, the debate had expanded into a broader discussion of the participation of African Americans in the technical fields. If the United States wanted to cultivate the best and brightest students in math and science, why waste the much-needed brain power of black children by sending them to inferior schools? Every day, Catherine Goebel, Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, and other Langley computers were proving that women were as good at math as men, and that African Americans were just as gifted at math as anyone else. A woman engineer. Mary Jackson was putting her math skills to good use in her new job. From the beginning of her assignment in the wind tunnel research section, Mary's new boss, Kazimierz Czarniecki, had shown Mary how to work the controls of their wind tunnel for her group, firing up the tunnel's roaring engine and positioning models in the test section. The research in her division was used to design missiles, which were of great interest to the United States government for their possible military use. In its final form, her work became the 1958 report co-authored with her boss, Effects on Nose Angle and Mach Number on Transition on Cones at Supersonic Speeds. Mary's new boss was so impressed with her work that he suggested she enroll in Langley's engineer training program. Her ability and passion were apparent, and she had a mentor, her boss, who believed in her. It didn't matter that Mary was black and Kaz was white. It didn't matter that Mary was a woman and Kaz was a man. It didn't matter that Mary was from the South and Kaz was from the North. What mattered was that they both loved math and they both loved airplanes. Kaz knew that Mary had the talent to be an engineer. At the time, there were very few white women who worked as engineers. The majority of Langley's female professionals, black and white, were still classified as computers or mathematicians. There simply weren't many female engineers anywhere in the country. At the time, most of the country's top engineering schools didn't accept women. The only female engineer at Langley in the mid-1950s, Kitty O'Brien Joyner, had to sue the University of Virginia in order to enroll in the undergraduate engineering school in 1939. There were also very few African American men who worked as engineers. Mary was on her way to becoming something even rarer, an African American woman working as an engineer. In 1952, Howard University had had only two female engineering graduates in the school's history. In fact, Mary was on track to become the first female African American engineer at Langley. Mary's boss put her on the engineering track and promised her a promotion when she successfully completed a few advanced math courses. When she went to enroll in her courses, the obstacle she encountered came not from her co-workers, but from the local high school. Before she could get any training, Mary had to get permission to enter Hampton High School. If she had been the janitor, she would have been welcomed. As a professional engineer in training, she had to petition the city of Hampton for special permission to attend classes in the whites-only school. Mary Jackson had to grit her teeth and take a deep breath before making the case to the school board that she should be allowed to attend the classes at Hampton High School. She reminded herself that she had a long-term goal, and she didn't want to get sidetracked. So she swallowed her pride and asked for permission, which the city of Hampton granted. The disappointment of Hampton High School. Mary Jackson had passed the old Hampton High School too many times to count. The building was located in the middle of the city, not far from her house, but she had never set foot inside. On her first night of class in the spring of 1956, Mary was nervous. Her classmates were the same people she had worked with during the day for the past 5 years, but she was anxious about meeting with them outside of the Langley campus. The thought of entering the whites-only school also worried Mary. Nothing could have prepared her for the shock she experienced when she walked through the door. Hampton High School was a dilapidated, musty old building. Mary Jackson was stunned. This was what she and the rest of the black children in the city had been denied all these years? She had assumed that if whites had worked so hard to deny her admission to the school, it must have been a beautiful place. But this? What a nonsensical thing that black and whites went to different schools. If the city had combined its resources, it could have built one beautiful school for both black and white students. Throughout the South, cities had maintained two separate and inefficient school systems, which shortchanged both black and white students. Pioneers. Being on the leading edge of the battle over integration was not for the faint of heart. Mary Jackson was friends with Thomas Birdsong, a black engineer who had come to Langley in 1952. Mary's husband, Levi, was an excellent cook, and Thomas Birdsong loved going to the Jacksons' house for dinner. The friends laughed and talked, often discussing work, and enjoyed Levi's meals. As a recent graduate of the University of Michigan, Birdsong had been assigned to a senior engineer in a wind tunnel division. His boss instructed him on how to conduct his first test, then assigned him a partner, a mechanic, to assist and answer questions. The mechanic, a white man with years of experience at the lab, sabotaged Birdsong's first experiment by incorrectly attaching the model during the test. Birdsong knew he had been undermined, but he didn't say anything. He was from the South and knew all too well that many people would defend a white man over a black man in any kind of dispute. When Birdsong presented his data, his boss recognized that he had been sabotaged and was irate. "You will never do that again to this man or anyone else. Do you understand me?" the boss shouted at the mechanic. Birdsong went out of his way to remain calm at work, but keeping his anger bottled up wasn't good for him either. In general, black men at Langley were more likely to have trouble over racial issues than black women. Their good manners and gracious attitudes did not always protect them. Though the white engineers were typically polite and respectful to the black men, it was often the blue-collar mechanics, model makers and technicians who were threatened and made the African Americans feel unwelcome. For Thomas Birdsong, the constant battle against race wore him down. Like Catherine Goebel, he found a way to opt out of the segregated facilities. Each day at lunchtime, he and a friend escaped to a black-owned restaurant just outside the entrance to the Air Force Base. There, he could be himself. Ultimately, Thomas Birdsong, Mary Jackson, and each of the other African Americans at Langley had to navigate race relations in their own way. The challenges facing black employees at the laboratory reflected the similar conflicts happening all over the country. The civil rights movement was gaining strength, and African Americans nationwide were trying to establish their rights and freedoms in the classrooms, in the voting booths, and in the halls of Congress, where legislative reforms were being considered. On the world stage, chilly relations between the United States and the Soviet Union kept everyone uneasy. The two world powers were vying for control of Earth and outer space, challenging one another politically and technologically. Each country wanted to demonstrate its scientific prowess and dominate the skies. The world was on the cusp of making new discoveries that would allow mankind to experience outer space. There was one central question. Who would get there first? Chapter 15. Young, Gifted, and Black. While Mary Jackson was busy at work helping the NACA build supersonic airplanes, girls in high school were beginning to imagine different possibilities for themselves. Even though teaching was still the best option available, there were now more career choices. On October 5, 1957, Christine Mann, a senior at the Allen School for Girls in Asheville, North Carolina, left her dorm room first thing in the morning and walked to the library. Her job was to open the library and organize the newspapers and magazines before anyone else arrived. She took a moment to read the headlines as she set up the displays. Since the beginning of the school year, newspapers around the country had discussed the racial crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas. 9 black teenagers trying to integrate the all-white Central High School had turned that state's capital city into a military battleground. The Arkansas National Guard had been called out to prevent the black students from entering the school. In response, the federal government sent U.S. Army troops to escort the 9 students into the school. The crisis unfolded over days, and each morning, Christine followed the news of the brave children who were close to her in age. The showdown had dominated the headlines, and then the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. The Russians did it. They had created a satellite and launched it into orbit, and they did it before the United States. With tensions between the two countries already high because of the Cold War, this news put everyone further on edge. The United States needed to catch up. At the Langley Memorial Aeronautics Laboratory, there was great pressure to outperform the Russians at 360 miles above Earth, the altitude at which a satellite would fly around the planet. For the engineers, beating the Russians in space was a matter of personal and professional pride. In the rest of the country, the fear was political. "Red-made satellite flashes across U.S.," read the Daily Press in Newport News. "Sphere tracked in 4 crossings over U.S.," read the New York Times. When Christine read the news, she felt she had fallen asleep in one world and awakened in another. October 4, 1957, marked the end of the post-war era, a time when the world was rebuilding after the destruction of World War II. The morning of October 5th was the official dawn of the space age, the beginning of mankind's realizing a long-held dream to fly beyond Earth's atmosphere and visit outer space. President Dwight D. Eisenhower tried to dismiss the Russians' small ball in the air as an insignificant achievement, but the American people knew better. Sputnik, some experts declared, was nothing less than a technological declaration of war. The Russians had won the first battle, but the space race was just getting started. The Sputnik Age. For the third time in the century, the United States found itself falling behind other countries technologically during a period of international tension. On the cusp of World War I, the country didn't have enough airplanes, so the government created the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. At the start of World War II, America's aircraft industry lagged behind Germany's, but during the war, it surged to global dominance. Now the threat came from the Soviet Union. It wasn't just Sputnik. The Soviet Union had missiles, perhaps hundreds of them, with the power to reach U.S. cities and deliver nuclear bombs. A new term began to make the rounds in policy circles, the press, and private conversations. The missile gap. Black newspapers and their readers wasted no time in making the link between America's inadequacy in space and the dreadful conditions facing many black students in the South. While we were forming mobs to drive Authorine Lucy, the black woman who integrated the University of Alabama in 1956, from the Alabama campus, the Russians were compelling all children to attend the best possible schools, argued the Chicago Defender. Until the United States changed its views on racial inequality and gave the same opportunities to all students, it would never be able to lead the world, the newspaper commented. An editorial in the Cleveland Call-In Post echoed that idea. Who can say that it was not the institution of the Jim Crow school that has deprived this nation of the black scientist who might have solved the technological kinks delaying our satellite launching? For Christine Mann, reading the news brought mixed emotions. She felt fear, certainly. She had been just 3 years old when the first atomic bombs were dropped on Japan. She was part of the first generation in the history of the world to grow up with the possibility of the human race becoming extinct due to nuclear war. The hostility between the United States and the Soviet Union made the country anxious about nuclear war. Black and yellow triangular fallout shelter signs popped up in public spaces, pointing the way to underground bomb shelters that were supposed to provide protection in the event of a nuclear attack. At school, students practiced duck and cover drills under their desks. At the same time, Christine felt a sense of wonder, even a thrill, to see a satellite circling Earth in the skies above. The world beyond Earth had always been a mysterious place. Space travel was becoming a natural next step for the restless inhabitants of Earth, not just the subject of science fiction. What had been a dream was becoming reality. Christine and many other Americans worried that the Soviets had traveled into space before the Americans. "We can't let them beat us," she thought, echoing the sentiments shared by those who worked at the Langley Laboratory and citizens across America. A new day. 3 years before Christine Mann's parents enrolled her at the Allen School, she had attended a public school in Monroe, North Carolina. She remembered the day in 1954 when the principal stepped into her eighth grade classroom and made an announcement. "I just came to let you all know that the Supreme Court just ruled on Brown versus Board of Education, and you will be going to school with white students in the future." The judges in the five legal cases known together as Brown versus Board of Education ruled that it was illegal to separate black and white students in public schools. In fact, the Brown versus Board of Education court cases had a special connection for Dorothy Vaughan. A 16-year-old girl named Barbara Johns, a student at Moton High School in Farmville, where Dorothy had taught, had grown tired of Moton's overcrowded classrooms and tattered textbooks. When one of the school's broken-down school buses crashed, killing five of her classmates, Barbara decided to take action. She led her fellow students in a strike, refusing to go to school until authorities improved the black school's conditions. Dorothy Vaughan's relatives were among the participants. Barbara then contacted lawyers who helped the students file a lawsuit against the county school board. It took years, but the lawsuit filed by Barbara Johns and her classmates eventually made its way to the Supreme Court, where it became part of the Brown decision. It was a victory for those who wanted to abolish segregation in America's public schools, but it would also mean a big change for both whites and blacks. Christine and her classmates were shocked when the principal made the announcement. She lived in the segregated part of a small southern town where all of her neighbors were black. The doctors, the teachers, the street sweepers, everyone. Most of the black men in her part of town earned a living working for the railroad. Black women worked in the cotton mill or as housekeepers. Segregation was all that Christine had ever known, so she worried about the Brown decision. She feared that she and her classmates would not be good enough or smart enough to succeed in a classroom of white children. How could she and other African-American students coming from overcrowded classrooms with old textbooks compete with the kids who lived in the white section of town across the railroad tracks? But Christine's parents, just like Dorothy Vaughan's, Catherine Goebel's, and Mary Jackson's, would do anything they could to help their daughters succeed. They believed in education, honesty, hard work, and character. Christine's father earned a good living as an insurance salesman. Hers was one of the few black families in town that owned a car, a Pontiac Hydromatic, and Christine's time at the Allen School was providing her with the best possible start in life. A charismatic 11th grade geometry teacher sparked Christine's interest in math, and she began to consider a future that would use her skills as a mathematician. Christine followed in the family tradition of attending a black college. She chose Hampton Institute. The summer before her senior year, Christine had accompanied a friend to the friend's sister's graduation from the school, and she had fallen in love with the elegant campus and balmy breezes from the ocean. She applied to Hampton and received a scholarship from the United Negro College Fund. Christine graduated from the Allen School in May 1958. From the time Sputnik took flight in October 1957 until she addressed her classmates as valedictorian in the spring, the Soviets had launched two more satellites, Sputnik 2 and Sputnik 3. In August 1958, Christine left North Carolina and with her family drove north to the Hampton Institute campus. She didn't know it at the time, but her decision to move to Hampton would make her a part of the tradition of women working as mathematicians at Langley. The mountains of North Carolina flattened out as Christine's family drove toward the coast. She always loved the mountains, but when she saw the James River, so broad and measured in its flow as it joined Chesapeake Bay, the sight took her breath away. Crossing that river as she closed in on Hampton, Virginia, made Christine feel like anything was possible. Chapter 16. What a difference a day makes. Christine Mann wasn't the only person who spent her evening staring up at the sky. Catherine Goebel stood outside on a warm October night in 1957 and watched the winking dot of light in the sky as it moved low across the horizon. At Langley Memorial Aeronautics Laboratory in Hampton, Virginia, and across the country, Americans turned their eyes skyward with a mixture of wonder and terror. As they tried to see Sputnik from their backyards, they asked themselves, could the 183-pound metal sphere launched into orbit by the Russians see them too? It became a game as they surfed the radio dial, trying to lock onto the sound of the satellite beeping, a sound like that of an otherworldly cricket. This was Sputnik. In the 1940s, designing aircraft capable of flying beyond Earth's atmosphere had seemed too far-fetched. Now, with Sputnik circling overhead every 96 minutes, Americans wanted to know how the United States had fallen behind. The stakes were high, or it seemed that way at the time. First in space means first, period, said Senate Majority Leader Lyndon B. Johnson. Second in space is second in everything. The challenge of space. Catherine Goebel had wondered what the next challenge would be for Langley researchers, and Sputnik gave her the answer. Space had long been a dirty word at airplane-focused Langley, something that the researchers weren't really supposed to spend their time working on. Congress had warned the researchers not to waste taxpayer money on science fiction and dreams of manned spaceflight. The laboratory was tasked with designing and improving aircraft that had practical applications right here on Earth. That didn't stop Langley engineers from imagining how missile shapes and rocket engines and solutions to re-entry problems involved in high-speed flight research might apply to space vehicles. Any aircraft that traveled into space first had to pass through the layers of Earth's atmosphere, accelerating through the sound barrier and then escaping the pull of Earth's gravity before settling into the 18,000 miles per hour speed that characterized objects locked into low Earth orbit. On the return trip, the same vehicle would have to skid through the friction of the increasingly dense atmosphere, encountering heat that could reach 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit before falling back to Earth. Now that the Russians had a head start in space, the United States was eager to join the race, but engineers debated about how to start. Some favored an aircraft designed like a plane that could elegantly orbit Earth and then glide back through the atmosphere, but that might take too much time. With beating the Russians now a national priority, engineers felt pressure to find the quickest, surest way into space. The Flight Research Division, where Katherine Goebel worked, specialized in doing research involving real planes, not parts or models, like people who worked in the wind tunnels. Another group at Langley, the Pilotless Aircraft Research Division, PARD, specialized in rockets and had set up a test range on Wallops Island off the Virginia coast where test rockets could be launched. In previous tests, the group's rockets had reached speeds of Mach 15 in flight, and the engineers in PARD were confident that their vehicles were powerful enough to lift a satellite and human passenger into orbit. The engineers in the Flight Research Division and in PARD were eager to test their ideas about how to catch up to the Russians in space. From the NACA to NASA. A number of agencies wanted to manage the space program. The U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Naval Research Observatory, and the Army Ballistic Missile Agency bid for the assignment. But the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, where Katherine, Mary, Dorothy, and the other female computers worked, was chosen to lead the efforts. It was an exciting time for them all. Hampton, Virginia was going to be the center of the space program. In October 1958, the U.S. government combined all of the various space-related groups. The expanded agency had a new name, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA. The NACA had become NASA, but the change meant more than just a different name. While the NACA had been quiet, obscure, and largely unnoticed, NASA would be very high profile and high stakes, and scrutinized by the world. And the women working here would have higher profile jobs too. The work done by the NACA engineers had been hidden behind the more public operations of the military and commercial aircraft manufacturers. NASA was tasked to provide for the widest practicable and appropriate dissemination of information concerning its activities. That meant the work done at NASA belonged to every American. All of its actions, its moments of triumph, and its heartbreaking failures and tragedies were to be laid bare to the citizens and broadcast on television. Katherine Goebel also wanted to beat the Russians. She didn't want the Sputnik challenge to go unanswered. In addition to national pride, she personally longed to do something untried, untested, and unexplored. Katherine wanted to be part of the team that would figure out how to send humans into space. The end of West computing. As the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, which called for the creation of NASA, made its way through Congress, another memo quietly circulated through the Langley Research Center, the former Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory. The West Area Computing Unit is dissolved. Slowly but surely, women from West Computing like their white counterparts, had begun to receive permanent assignments in different engineering groups. Now, only 9 women remained in Dorothy's pool. Dorothy Vaughan had seen this day coming since the East Computing Pool was disbanded in 1947. Each new facility in the laboratory fueled the demand for specialization among its professionals, including the mathematicians. The idea of operating a central computing pool had become obsolete. The computing pool had created rare opportunities for women at the NACA. Getting hired by the laboratory as a professional mathematician had been an important and groundbreaking step for women, especially the African-American women. But now the times were changing. Aeronautical research had become more complex, and the laboratory needed mathematicians with specialized knowledge. Women like Dorothy Hoover, Catherine Goebel, and Mary Jackson had gotten their start in West Computing and moved on. Now it was time for the pool itself and its leader to move on too. The days of the West Computing office had come to an end. The end of West Area Computing was bittersweet to Dorothy Vaughan. On the one hand, it meant the end of segregation at Langley. Now the black women would work with white engineers and white computers instead of having to stay in their own office. Dorothy had worked hard to support the careers of women like Catherine Goebel and Mary Jackson and give West Computing a reputation for doing work that was as good as that of their white colleagues. The end of West Computing was, in many ways, a long-fought-for victory. The standards upheld by the women of West Computing created opportunities for a new generation of women with passion for math and hopes for a career beyond teaching. On the other hand, it meant the end of Dorothy's career as a manager. It had taken her 8 years to reach her seat at the front of the West Computing office. For 7 years after that, she ruled a room full of black female mathematicians doing research at the world's most prestigious aeronautical laboratory. But now she, too, was being moved to another group with a new boss. Dorothy was 48 years old in October 1958. Her older children were now entering college. She was proud of the way she had navigated through the days of racial segregation, proud of whatever small share she might claim in fighting prejudice with intellectual merit. During her years at West Computing, Dorothy had watched scores of women move from the computing pool to other positions within the laboratory. She and the other female computers had proven that given the opportunity and support, women were just as smart as men. Dorothy had never been one to linger over the past. For better or worse, Langley's fresh start was giving Dorothy Vaughan a fresh start as well. Chapter 17. Writing the Textbook on Space. The staff at the Langley Research Center had very few resources to teach engineers about outer space. To bring the entire laboratory up to speed, Catherine Goebel's branch chief organized a lecture series to take place from February to May 1958. He asked his team, the engineers in the flight research and the pilotless aircraft research divisions, to present the lectures on a range of topics from the solar system to problems with re-entry from outer space into Earth's atmosphere. The lectures were a crash course in all things aeronautic. Catherine Goebel loved learning everything she could about space travel. She was delighted when the engineers in her group assigned her the task of preparing charts for use in these space technology lectures. In essence, she was helping the engineers write the first real textbook about outer space. Always curious, Catherine listened to everything her co-workers said. She read every word of Aviation Week, a magazine about flight. She drained every drop of knowledge from the engineers she worked with, but that was not enough. The real action, she knew, was taking place in the lectures and editorial meetings. Those private closed-door gatherings where engineers reviewed and discussed the most recent research reports. She wanted to be part of those talks, but the men in charge would not allow it. a place at the table. Building an airplane was nothing compared to getting research through Langley's grueling literature review process. Present your case, build it, sell it so they believe it. That was the Langley way. Authors of a NASA technical report had to talk about their research and give a lot of information to convince everyone that their theory was correct. Then they faced questions from 4 or 5 people chosen for their expertise in a topic. Sometimes these questions were really tough. The committee members looked for inaccuracies, inconsistencies, incomprehensible statements, and illogical conclusions in the report. After clearing the technical hurdles, a report went through a style, clarity, and grammatical check. A final report might take months or even years to complete. Catherine Goebel sat down with the engineers to review the requirements for the space technology lectures and the research reports that were coming out of the presentations. She asked lots of questions so that she completely understood the problem set before her. "Why can't I go to the editorial meetings?" she asked the engineers.
"Girls don't go to the meetings," her colleagues said.
"Is there a law against it?" she asked. There wasn't, of course. It wasn't personal, the engineers told her. It was just the way things had always been done. The no-woman rule was a matter of practice, not policy. Langley gave each division chief and branch head the power to manage their own groups. These male bosses decided whether a woman was promoted, if she got a raise, or if she was permitted to attend meetings. Women at Langley had to learn how to work with men. They needed to be polite, but not so polite that they seemed timid. For the most part, men were engineers and women were computers. Men did the analytical thinking, and women did the calculations. Men gave the orders, and women took the notes. Unless an engineer was given a compelling reason to see a woman as a peer, she remained in his blind spot. Even the smartest woman might get stuck doing repetitive, humdrum work unless someone paid attention and gave her a chance. Women like Catherine Goebel found their work interesting, just like the men did. For the women who found their true calling at NASA, they matched their male colleagues in curiosity, passion, and the ability to withstand pressure. The problem was that women had to get over the high hurdle of low expectations. They needed to prove that they were just as good as men and should be held to the same standards and given the same opportunities. Whatever personal insecurities Catherine Goebel may have had about being a woman working with men or about being one of the few blacks in a white workplace, she didn't let them bother her. Male or female, black or white, as far as Catherine was concerned, once she got to the office, they were all the same. "Why can't I go to the editorial meetings?" Catherine Goebel asked again. On this issue, like any other, she kept up the questioning until she received a satisfactory answer. Her requests came across as gentle but persistent. She wasn't going to let the issue drop. The greatest adventure in the history of humankind was happening in the office next door, and she wanted to be part of it.
"Let her go,"
one of the men finally said, exasperated. The others agreed, no doubt tired of saying no. Who were they must have figured, to stand in the way of someone so committed to making a contribution? In 1958, Catherine Goebel finally made it to the editorial meetings of the Guidance and Control Branch of Langley's Flight Research Division, soon to be renamed the Aerospace Mechanics Division of NASA. She took her place at the table where she knew she belonged. She had a lot to learn and a lot to offer. Chapter 18. With All Deliberate Speed. In 1958, Catherine Goebel and her research group took on what seemed like the world's most interesting challenge, sending a human being into space. NASA reorganized the research teams so that they were doing all they could to turn spaceflight from a comic book fantasy into a reality. The Space Task Group,
set up to be the nerve center of the new operation, was made up of many engineers and female computers from Catherine's group, the Flight Research Division, and PARD, the rocket specialists. The new group decided that their first space